Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
Last week we talked about the cognitive machinery in our heads, machinery that predisposes us towards and actually enables us to have spiritual experiences. We unpacked two or three dozen of our previous episodes which looked at this cognitive machinery and how it shapes our thinking and our experience of reality, our conversation, our science, our whole philosophy and theology. And we did that because I've been mulling over the past few weeks, asking myself, is all this religious stuff just in my head? So Scott and I walked through all of those previous episodes and tried to answer that question, but we were only scratching the surface. I mean, what do we know? We may have done a lot of reading, but at the end of the day, we're not scholars in this area. But then the strangest coincidence happened. As I just said, I had been thinking about these questions for a few weeks and talked about it with several people close to me, including Scott, and created the script for the episode you heard last week. All that stuff about the machinery in our head, the hypersensitive agency detector, and the promiscuous teleology detector, the emotion of awe, and the neural pathways that can be activated by hallucinogenic drugs to mimic a spiritual experience, and how we came to possess that machinery, whether it evolved in humans, or whether it was bestowed on us by some higher being, by God, and either way, the reason why we possessed it. So we polished the script up for that episode and made plans to record it a few days later. But the very next morning, I was reading the latest issue of a magazine I subscribed to, Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith, and I noticed an article by an author that I recognized, with a title that sounded like it might be related to what we'd been discussing, something about the evolution of religion. Naturally, I went straight to that article as I ate my breakfast, and my jaw dropped when I started reading that author's ideas on the hypersensitive agency detector and the promiscuous teleology detector and the other neural processing pathways that evolved in our heads down through human history, and the philosophical reasons for how all of that was not an accident, not an evolutionary spandrel, but something that was built into us over the course of human evolution to bring us to an awareness of a divine creator. That author, that scholar, went through a lot of paleontological science and history, a lot of psychology and neurobiology, and some sprinkles of material from prominent theologians. And at the end of reading it, I immediately contacted the author. I told him, you got to come. You have got to share your perspective with us on this topic. And the next day, Wednesday, he said yes. And here he is in our studio right now, Chris, Dr. Chris Berger. Welcome to our podcast.
Well, thank you, Luke and Scott. It's a real joy to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
Chris, you've been our guest before, 4 years ago, two episodes, in fact, the first of which had you telling us quite a bit of your personal story, a very fascinating one, a journey that started in a very evangelical setting, getting a PhD in philosophy, and then going to seminary to prepare for full-time Christian ministry. But a missionary trip to India and an unpleasant encounter with the Christian ministry there had you rejecting your Christian faith, exploring other world religions, including, of course, Buddhism, and eventually to full-on atheism. But you were still on an intellectual search for meaning in the universe, and that eventually brought you back to a Christian faith and full-time ministry. We're not going to repeat that whole story here again. We did it almost a whole episode on that story 4 years ago. And we'd point our listeners back to that episode, number 29, if they want to know the details. But Chris, maybe you can tell us where you're at now and if anything's changed since we last talked to you.
Yeah, thank you, Luke. I'm continue to be confident in the gospel that we serve. My understanding of that gospel and of its source in, you know, in Emmanuel, God with us in Jesus, continues to be a journey. And so this most recent article on, you know, the place of anthropology and cognitive science of religion is part of that ongoing journey. But I have the privilege of pastoring a congregation that is interested in these questions. And so part of this journey since I last talked to you has been an increasing sense of being part of a worshiping community that is exploring these sorts of questions and validates just the validity as disciples of Christ to actually be able to ask these questions. God saying, you know, it's okay that you ask questions.
Right.
In fact, you know, I think for parents to have children who do not ask questions, you'd be worried about them developmentally.
And
so I think likewise with God and us, you know, questions are not something that are, you know, questions about faith and how the world fits together with God and questions of science and evolution and so forth are not signs of doubt, as, you know, some of my earlier Christian communities would say, but signs of just seeking to understand and grow and, you know, in faith and discipleship and that kind of exciting journey. So yeah, those are some immediate thoughts, Luke, in terms of where I am today.
It's encouraging to hear you say that there is that kind of a group out there. It's not kind of a widespread thing to find churches and groups that are welcoming to that kind of approach. So it's very encouraging. It must be very invigorating to be pastoring that kind of a group.
Yeah, it's not always easy. One of the things I do with my preaching is I open up the floor for questions, comments afterwards. In an age where, well, I minister in the context of Quebec, a very secular, indeed anti-religious society. The church has compromised its own integrity and its witness, you know, through time. And so one of the ways that I respond constructively in that ministry environment is by a sense of vulnerability, ministering out of a sense of vulnerability rather than a top-down authority. And part of that vulnerability is just, you know, opening myself up after a sermon to questions, disagreement. And so I think it's all part of what's kind of necessary in our ministry context of saying, you know, we actually don't serve a God with a big stick. We actually serve a God who is concerned for growth in all dimensions of our complex humanity. And yeah, it's just a privilege to be a part of a community kind of on that journey. And one of the things I say to our folk is, in Luke's gospel, what are Jesus' last words on the cross? His last words are actually a question. Why, God, have you abandoned me? And if Jesus is allowed to ask that kind of question, surely we are too. So those elements of our community. And it is indeed, as you say, Scott, a privilege to be part of that.
Okay. So the question that we're going to explore today then again is why we have all this specific wiring and software in our heads, which predisposes us humans to spiritual experiences and religion making. And before we get into that subject, I just wanted to talk a little bit about who really can be speaking to this question. Psychologists have been developing ways to measure what's going on inside our heads during a spiritual or religious experience. We've got neurobiologists mapping out the neural pathways underlying that. Paleontologists, fossil nerds, finding statues and cave paintings and other evidence of religious activity. Literary scholars studying ancient manuscripts and clay tablets, which record a lot of our religious thinking in its early stages. And then philosophers and theologians arranging the pieces and trying to make sense out of all the data. And here's the thing. Some people might think that the scientists in that group might have a preferred status over their philosopher and theologian colleagues. I don't think so, but Chris, what do you have to say to that?
Let's say of an agnostic or atheist bent, do have what we would call what we as philosophers would call metaphysical assumptions. That's basically a fancy word for saying assumptions about the ultimate nature of reality. And so, when an atheist or agnostic natural scientist says that the natural sciences are the ultimate criteria or voice on the way things are, then that's actually importing a metaphysical assumption, an assumption about ultimate reality that is not defensible by science. Science has nothing to say about the metaphysical world. This is because the science is about the physical world. And so those kind of claims are, even if they're often couched in scientific terms, like it's a scientific claim that there is no ultimate reality beyond the physical world, that's not a scientific claim. That is a philosophical claim. And so philosophical perspective and the theological perspective has two advantages, I think. One is, first, it's honest about its metaphysical claims. It's not trying to hide the metaphysical claims. It's saying, that's what we're doing. We are making metaphysical claims here. Second advantage, I think, is that it can speak more, I would say, holistically or openly to both the origins of where everything comes from and where it's all going, the telos of where everything of the physical world. And so, yeah, I would say the philosophers and theologians do have a whole lot to learn from the scientists. I think also the scientists have a whole lot to learn from the philosophers and theologians, likewise. And so in terms of these big questions, let me name three questions. One, origins, which I mentioned. Second, telos, which I just mentioned. Third, meaning. What is the ultimate meaning of all this? Is there meaning? And so those three dimensions, which encompass the physical, are the domain of philosophers and theologians, and those are pretty foundational issues. So yes, I would agree with what you're saying there, Luke, just in terms of the importance of those roles.
Right, and that core assumption, whether there is a God, I mean, that's ultimately what you're saying, that assumption can be held by scientists as well as by philosophers, as well as by theologians, or the assumption that there is no God. A lot of them, mm-hmm. a lot of scientists will assume that, but even philosophers, and I'd argue even some theologians might argue that there's not a God. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I was going to say was, basically to put the words that you just said, Chris, into more of a mundane example. So you use words like telos and things like that. But for the average person, let's talk about a chair. A scientist, an engineer can measure a chair. It can measure all the angles and all the load-bearing statistics and the length of the legs and the arms, and basically describe it in all kinds of immense engineering scientific detail. But a philosopher would be just as qualified as those scientists to talk about what is a chair for? You know, what does it do? What can you use it for? Both are equally qualified to deal with that.
Yes. I mean, one area where philosophy and science overlap is on areas of the mind. So on the one hand, in science, we've got neuroscience, and the other side on philosophy, we've got philosophy of mind. And they're both talking about, you know, the brain and this thing that we call mind, however it may be connected to the brain. But when it comes to the chair, I think it's more the psychologist and the philosopher who can talk about causality. What's the cause of that chair coming into being? And its purpose. So yes, the technician, the engineer, the contractor can produce it and understand what, you know, it's being intended for. But there is intentionality behind it. And intentionality is the domain in different ways of, on the one hand, the psychologist, and on the other hand, of the philosopher as well.
So Chris, you did write this paper that caught our attention, this paper on the cognitive wiring in our heads and how that predisposes to a religious experience. But you began that paper looking at work done by some anthropologists who studied a lot of the background behind this. Dr. Robin Dunbar, an anthropologist and evolutionary psychologist and specialist in primate behavior, and a Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, a clinical psychiatrist with graduate training in anthropology. And you reviewed books that the two of them wrote. Dunbar wrote How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures, as well as Torrey's book with the title Evolving Brains, Emerging Gods, Early Humans and the Origins of Religion. So I'd like to take just 5 minutes and distill from those two books a few common themes in this question of the evolution of religion. And let's start, for example, both Dunbar and Torrey talked about theory of mind. Perhaps you could start there.
Sure. So the theory of mind is the idea that we attribute thoughts to other people. And there are what are called levels of theory of mind. So first level of theory of mind is I attribute a thought to you. You can have thoughts. A second level of theory of mind is that that I think that you are having thoughts about me. That's a different neurological process for me to think that you are having thoughts about me. Then a third level is I can think that you are having thoughts about someone else, about others. And we are capable of, most of us are capable of holding 4 or 5 levels of these sorts of thoughts. But the importance of theory of mind in this study of the anthropology of and evolution of religion is that the theory of mind capability neurologically emerged at a period in human evolutionary history. And theory of mind is an essential part of religious life, because what we're doing there is the capacity to attribute thoughts to a creator, to some ultimate mind. And so this ability to project thoughts or recognize thoughts in others is also then transferred to God. And then also that God might have thoughts about me. So second level theory of mind, that God might be having thoughts about me. And so it's the evolution of this and of these different stages of theory of mind that is seen as one of the essential elements in the emergence of humanity's capacity for religion.
And I like giving the audience examples that they can relate to. So just as an example of these different levels of theory of mind, the one that came to my mind, I'm a hunter. And so I just imagine I am watching a game warden who's watching a hunter hunting illegally at a coyote, and the coyote's watching a rabbit. And so the coyote's anticipating what the rabbit's about to do, but the hunter's anticipating what the coyote's going to do, game warden anticipating, and I'm watching all this. So would that be an example then of a fourth or a fifth order?
Yes. So what you're doing there is you're keeping in your mind what's happening in multiple other minds.
Yes. Mm.
As multiple other minds read other minds.
Right.
So absolutely. And so part of why that is important for our religious capacity is not only for our relationship with God and to think that God is having thoughts about me as well, but also to share in religious community. And so part of sharing in religious community, like any form of human community, is understanding or having thoughts about what others in the group, in the community, are having as well. Thoughts about me, thoughts about others. And then we get into all those complexity of human relationships. But yes, so what you've just described, Luke, is part of the different levels of theory of mind operating within community, and thereby making religious community, not just worship, not just prayer possible, but religious community as well.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking of as kind of a basis of civilization, and you could somewhat exchange those two terms, community and civilization, sure. That it creates the possibility of civilization, because now we can begin to, one thing that really comes to my mind is empathy. Because without a theory of mind, would it not be pretty difficult to have empathy for another? In other words, recognizing that they're having thoughts and that they're separate from me, and yet like me, mm-hmm. brings that whole issue of empathy, which lends itself to community and to morality and so on. And even morality, it seems to me, would only be possible with a more sophisticated theory of mind than. There are certainly animal communities, but they're very different from human communities as well, right?
No, it's interesting you raise the issue of empathy, because that adds another twist into the story. So there are differing interpretations from both the genetic and archaeological evidence, especially of the internal structure of brains, or the skull rather, that paleoanthropologists try to interpret when in our evolutionary history, empathy would have come along. And so there are different reconstructions of that history, because the evidence is fairly circumstantial. When we're reconstructing this evolutionary development of how our brains have developed, the brain tissue is not there anymore for us to look at. So these are hypothetical reconstructions. So in terms of when did empathy come along, one of these two authors we've been talking about, Dunbar and Tori, says that empathy came along before theory of mind. And so there's various, archaeological reasons, and, he makes that argument. And so I would say that even if empathy did come along before theory of mind, so empathy being reading something about, and presumably reading suffering in, another person, another, a homo of some kind, another animal, that even if empathy did come along before theory of mind, I would agree, certainly significantly enhanced our capacity for empathy.
I did want to talk about exactly that. You just referred to Torrey's timeline. I wanted to talk to you about what you found with Torrey's timeline and Dunbar's timeline. Let's talk, since you've already started now, on Torrey's timeline. He described, in the process of this evolution of humans and evolution of the religion, he talked about 7 or 8 distinct cognitive steps. And I'd like you to expand on them, but I'm just going to mention them here now, partly to let the audience give them some cues to latch onto. So Torrey talked about humans, hominids, going through a stage where they had increased levels of intelligence. You'd expect to need to have that. Eventually, enough intelligence gave them a sense of self. They began to be introspective. In the process of learning about looking at themselves, they looked at others. So empathy, this word, this empathy for others. And then, as you said, that led to a theory of mind. But then hominids, and this is over millions of years, different levels of evolution, they then began to develop a sense of the past and the future, you know, the need to store food for the future. But that led to the idea of ancestors, and then ancestors gave them a sense of gods. And of course, then from that, we have the evolution of moral and ethical laws and religion. So those are those 7 or 8 different steps of evolution that Torrey talked about, hominids went through, and how that led to the evolution of religion. Maybe you could unpack several more of those. You've already talked about the empathy and the theory of mind, but maybe a couple of those other points.
Yeah, I think just stepping back for a moment before I do that, I think the important thing to note here that I'm trying in the article to understand from atheistic and specifically Christian perspective is that these capacities are multiple elements that build into our human capacity for religion, and they have evolved in stages and accumulated over a long duration of time. And so that's the larger picture that I'm trying to incorporate into my theological vision. So now to your question, Luke, about some of these specific stages, I think one that I found particularly helpful is Torrey's reference to, and this is central for him, of the what he calls the narrative mind, not the narrative mind, the autobiographical mind. Homo brains did not always have a sense of past or future. So Torrey says that first, I forget, maybe a million years ago, whichever stage he says, there was the Homo brain developed the ability to recognize a sense of self. I actually exist. Wow. Okay. So that's a sense of in the present. But eventually, we also developed an ability to actually look backwards and look forwards. In other words, to create a story about ourselves. And so this is what he calls the autobiographical mind, the sense that my life actually is part of a story. I have a past and I have a future. Now, the reason that's so important in his understanding of the emergence of religion is because it raises questions. Once you have a sense of earlier and later, behind and forward, then you start asking questions, well, how did that come about and where is it going? And what develops simultaneously in our human evolution, and he's putting this about 200,000 years ago, is the sense of we also dream. And in our dreams, people are visited by their beloved deceased ones. And so out of this dream capacity merged what happens in their dream world with their sense of personal story. And this develops the sense of there is an afterlife. If someone's coming to me in my dreams, they seem pretty real to me. They must be real. Where are they coming from? They must be coming from some other world beyond. And it must be that other world beyond that is both the source and the where we're going to it all. And so we see out of this emergence of autobiographical mind, this evolutionary development of a capacity to put our own lives in a story, that these important elements of religion begin to come about, this ultimate reality beyond this physical world that gives us answers for where we come from, where we're going after death.
So that's Torrey's timeline. And I found that fascinating reading, just those 7 or 8 distinct cognitive steps that all hominids went through that eventually led to present-day humans, you know, building religions. Dunbar also had a timeline. It looked very different. Not that he disagreed with Torrey. He was unpacking different ideas. He was looking at it from a different perspective. And so he talked about humans as Paleolithic hunter-gatherer ancestors 20 or 50,000 years ago in Africa, who very likely had some concept of a spirit world, but then migrating into Europe and Asia, becoming Neolithic farmers, settling down in large cities 10,000 years ago. But living in a city with hundreds or thousands of other hominids, with that produced all kinds of potential for conflict. So this brought on a need for moral and ethical codes and laws and hierarchies of leadership. And then eventually you've got these full-fledged religions. So maybe speak a little bit to Dunbar's timeline and his migration out of Africa.
Yeah. So the two authors are quite interesting because although they do have some points of disagreement fundamentally about the purpose of why religion has originated, nonetheless, they complement each other in some very interesting ways. And so this is one of the ways they do, is because Torrey's emphasis is over understanding what's happened evolutionarily along the last couple million years, whereas Dunbar's emphasis is more on recent times, recent meaning since time of hunter-gatherers. So he probably more the last 15, 20,000 years, something like that. So very different timelines. And so, and Dunbar is also more interested than Torrey on our actual practices, religious practices, whereas Torrey's more interested in what's going on in our brains as they evolve. So Dunbar does some interesting research just about how religion operates and exists between hunter-gatherers and the transition to more settled life and to urbanization, that whole process. And so Dunbar's thesis is that religion has come about basically to help groups cohere, achieve stability together. We humans find it hard to get along, and so we need to find ways to do this. And part of what's happening in the creation of religion is that we have brain processes going on that build communities. So for instance, engaging in ritual together it releases endorphins that give people a sense of bondedness together. And so religious practices such as ritual or liturgy gather people together and have this ability not only to bond people together in the synchronicity of religious activities such as prayer, such as singing. So not only to bond people together, but religion has this added benefit for him of being able to keep larger groups bonded together. So for instance, he compares Homo sapiens today with, for instance, chimpanzees and gorillas and the sizes of groups that they are able to maintain. They're only able to maintain much smaller communities, 30 to 50 in a colony, for instance. Why is it that humans have developed this ability to hold together larger groups? And Dunbar's argument is that religion has been a central feature of that ability for us to stay together.
I found that those arguments, all that material really fascinating, because you can see how it applies in so many different areas. I mean, even in the context of the Christian world, when churches get to certain sizes, mm-hmm. you know, they all of a sudden they need hierarchy and so on. Whereas at the beginning, and if you look at the New Testament itself, you know, what starts as a very small movement in houses, you know, of friends and people who are of like mind, all of a sudden, I was quite shocked about how quickly Christianity became institutionalized. I mean, mm-hmm. relatively quickly, you have this whole hierarchy developing. And he certainly gave me a lot of food for thought about why that would be, because of the growing size to manage it. You know, there's this need to, and even things like dogma and so on would kind of, the development of dogma, I could see fitting very much into that. You know, the larger the group, the more dogma you need, right, to hold that group together. Yeah, sorry, Luke's smiling. Go ahead, Luke.
It's just interesting. You need dogma and rules to hold people together.
Well, I know it's.
Yeah. Okay. Now, another thing that Dunbar and Torrey did talk about was, and you did build on this a little bit, Chris, but I want to unpack this more. They talk about why, what would be the purpose of this evolution of religion? a lot of usually explanations from people such as Dunbar-Torrey, people who make the assumption that there is no God, they'll come up with an evolutionary reason. There's some kind of a selective advantage. And they did that, although they identified different driving forces behind that. So maybe if you could speak to that from their point of view, and then I'm going to draw out your own point of view, which has other assumptions.
Sure. So when we talk about purposes of evolution, or let's say more sources of evolution, there can be different types. So for instance, we can speak of adaptive evolution. We speak also of spandrels. So those are evolutionary kind of side effects with no particularly evolutionary advantage. Then we also speak of evolution that is simply turns into, like spandrels that turn into evolutionary advantages. So a classic example is the ability to dance is not, you know, evolutionarily intended, but it turns into an evolutionary advantage because you could perhaps attract a partner by dancing really well. In Dunbar's case, he sees the evolution of religion as adaptive. And so this is in contrast to views that see religion as maladaptive. So for instance, the so-called new atheists, Dawkins and Hitchens and so forth, they see religion as harmful to humanity or maladaptive from an evolutionary perspective. Dunbar argues that the energy investments that come with religious life, with commitments to religious community, with commitments to religious beliefs and practices and behaviors, is simply too high to be maladaptive. There's got to be an adaptive purpose for this expenditure of so much energy. So from an evolutionary perspective, that means there's got to be some a positive adaptive purpose to it. So he identifies the evolution of religion as adaptive, as I indicated earlier, for principally for social cohesion, and also because religion has this ability to scale up cohesion in ways that other human practices don't. Now, that's in contrast to Torrey. For Torrey, the evolution of religion is simply a spandrel. It's a side effect of this autobiographical mind. And so it's just kind of unfortunately there. So by the end of the book, he's written this whole book on the evolution of religion. And by the end of it, he gives this kind of sense of, oh, well, religion's going to be with us forever. So we just got to have to deal with it. So there's this grudging concession to the reality of religion, which is kind of I found it kind of an odd way to end the book after so much investment on his part in all this research and writing. But so those are the two contrasts between them. Neither one of them takes a maladaptive position. But Dunbar takes an adaptive position. Torrey takes a spandrel position.
In all of this discussion, there seems to be I don't know if you want to call it a leap or whatever, but on the one hand, you've got biological evolution, right? A scientifically established reality that we can demonstrate in all kinds of different ways and observe genetically and so on and so forth. But what we're talking about here is evolution at a very different level. It's more of a behavioral kind of evolution. It is rooted in biological evolution, because until the brains evolve certain neural capacities, that these behaviors wouldn't. But it seems to me there is a bit of a leap between then saying, okay, biological evolution, and now we apply the same paradigm, the same evolutionary kind of approach, although it has teleology kind of built into it, because we're talking a lot about purpose and things like that when we talk about behavior. Is there a gap between those two things? Is one as scientific as the other? Or have we made a kind of an unconscious, you know, we've taken biological evolution and extended it to a different level? And are those assumptions all still valid? And is that still a valid approach to analyzing the development of human behavior?
Right, that's such a great question. And it's a question that's asked even within, you know, secular anthropology, biology circles, because this theme of evolution gets applied to behavior, to social phenomena, not just religion, but other human social phenomena. And so this is actually a debate that occurs, you know, in the secular literature on, you know, is this legitimate to transfer one concept from one field to another field? So I think what's happening there is I mean, certainly once you move to this, this social and behavioral, you can do a reductionist move and say it's all simply variations on reproduction and survival. And so if you're taking that reductionist view, then I think it, you know, you can make the leap from pure, say, cell biology and so forth to social phenomena. But if you're a non-reductionist, I think you can use the term analogically, but saying within it all, there's a larger picture in which it all fits. So just back to what Luke was saying about Dunbar, part of what he's focusing on more intentionally than Torrey is the evolution, if you will, or to use a perhaps more neutral word, the development of religious practices and beliefs from hunter-gatherer societies to modern-day urban environments of, you know, tens of millions of people living in the same city. And that's a massive change in only a few thousand years in human development or evolution, whichever word you want to use. And so, yeah, that's part of what Dunbar is particularly tracing, is why those changes have happened. And it's the relationship of religion to those massive changes in humanity over the last 12, 15,000 years.
To reiterate then, Dunbar is saying that the driving force for these developments in our brains, the cognitive machinery that I refer to, the driving force for us getting that has to do with basically survival and reproduction. Those are the two main driving forces. That in some way, these things will enhance human reproduction and survival.
Right. And so the way that happens is we survive and therefore have greater opportunity for reproduction if we're in more secure groups. And so there is a question in the sociology and the evolutionary sociology of religion of which came first, big communities and then religion, or religion, then big communities. And so Dunbar's position is that larger communities started to emerge, then religion came along to help with the stresses that come on community building as communities get larger. In contrast to other views who have said, well, actually, religious capacity came along first and that enabled larger communities to evolve.
I want to emphasize, because I'm going somewhere, not I'm setting the stage for you to put your proposal on the table. So Dunbar is saying there was a driving force behind these cognitive changes, this machinery in our heads, and those the driving forces were enhanced reproduction and survival. But you've looked at the same data and you thought through and say, okay, yes, survival, reproduction, indeed. But there's some other element that you find explains a lot more about humans. And, and you are led there because you've now made a different assumption. Dunbar is making the assumption there is no God. You're saying, you know what? I'm going to see what this looks like if I take the assumption that there is a God. So why don't you unpack that?
Yeah, thank you, Luke. So if there is a God, it depends on what kind of God you're talking about. So you can say there are different forms of atheism. There are also different forms of theism or deism. So you could land on a position that there was a creator God who really didn't care about it all and created it all and just left it all to be. And there is that position in some, you know, some worldviews. I've landed elsewhere. I've landed on a position that there is a creator God, but this creator God is actually a personal God, a God of relationships, and therefore has created the universe or universes with an intention that there be relationships, that there be beings emerge in this creation, and not necessarily just on one planet. Could be, you know, emerging over billions of years elsewhere in multiple places across the universe, as you know, as the case may turn out to be. We don't know, but we do know that such beings have emerged on at least our planet, Earth. And so this whole evolutionary process that takes, you know, it's taken millions of years, not just that, the whole emergent process of the universe over billions of years has all been part of a creative strategy by this relational creator to bring about beings in relationship with the creator and with each other and in relationship to their physical environment as well. And so what that says to me as a consequence is that to say that evolution is merely about reproduction and survival is a needlessly minimalist or reductionist view. It's based on an assumption that's a coherent assumption, but can be a wrong assumption. And if one's worldview, our larger picture of it all is one in which there is actually a relational God behind it all, then evolution becomes something else. Evolution becomes a process to flourishing. And so that flourishing certainly includes reproduction and survival, but includes a much grander vision of what it's all about, of what survival looks like. Survival is not merely naked survival. It's about flourishing to be all that this creator envisions for the beings that have come about in that creation, beings of love, beings of creativity themselves, beings in relationship with God, and the multidimensionality of us. Did all this multidimensional amazingness and complexity to humanity and all of creation just simply come about for survival? Like, it doesn't connect. There's a deep disconnect there as I look at that. And so I just find it much more richer, intellectually and existentially satisfying account with equal scope of explanation, of explanatory power, as philosophers and scientists say, to have an understanding of it all, that it's all part of both a cause and a telos, a place where it's going, by a creator who has brought it all together. And so that's my vision of evolution, is as yes, it is for survival and procreation, but it's for much more than that, much richer vision of that, and what I would call a vision of flourishing. So evolution, the purpose of evolution is actually for flourishing in what God has created us to be as imago bearers, image of God bearers, and beings capable of love, loving each other, loving the world, loving this creator.
You said it comes down to one word, flourishing, but I also thought there's another word that you emphasize a lot in the paper, relationship.
Yeah, correct. In fact, in my, I have a brief version of this. I call the agape many roots account of God's design of the universe. And so what I describe that as is God's desire to bring about agape love capable beings, exercising, living out their image of God vocation, meaning reflecting the creator who has created us in our multidimensional relationality. So absolutely. So the sense of agape love as the Trinitarian heart, the relational heart of the Trinity, why we speak as Christians of a Trinitarian God, is also the heart of what this creation is about and our lives are about in their flourishing. So flourishing relationships.
This would bring in those various stages that Tori talked about, beginning with the sense of self, but then also the sense of empathy for others, theory of mind, then looking at relationship in the community, ancestors. So it brings it all together there as well.
Absolutely.
Scott?
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you brought up the word telos, teleology. Is civilization possible without teleology? In other words, does there not have to be some vision? It doesn't seem that to me that nihilism can lend itself very well to civilization. In other words, there needs to be a sense of where we're heading and what civilization should look like, right? And as soon as you start talking about that, you're into teleology of some form, right? Whether it's Christian or not, I'm not saying, but I'm just saying that how can you develop a worldview, a theory of civilization without some sense of what it ought to be? Chesterton brings this up in his book, the title's slipping my mind right now, but anyway, all about civilization. And basically, he says at the beginning, the problem is that we're trying to achieve something, but we don't know what it is. We first have to agree on what would a good civilization look like. Right. And that involves value judgments and purpose and that kind of thing. So on a purely random, meaningless, purposeless, materialist kind of understanding of the world, how do you then create civilization within that or in a sense? And I guess that's where you get into the whole created meaning and maybe the idea that, well, it doesn't matter. You would just create something. Yeah, like just, I think Sartre talked about that. We're meaning creating creatures, and there's kind of nothing in the center, but we have to create meaning anyway from kind of ex nihilo, kind of out of nothing.
Yes. I mean, I think that that's one way to describe the problems we face as societies. Humans have the capacity to create purpose for ourselves. Purpose is not something that is solely given by the Holy Spirit into our brains. Our brains are already capable of creating purpose. So we do create purposes. We often create purposes that are disconnected from God's sense of what our flourishing would look like. And so one example, I think, a big example, is where civilizations are built around the purposes that are just purely economic driven. And so that's much of where humanity, modern humanity defaults to is economic drivers, as creating as much wealth as we can. And so I think there's an example of, if that's your central purpose for a society or for a civilization, then you're immediately building that society on self-centeredness, self-interest, greed, and so forth. So absolutely, a society that's healthy needs a sense of purpose that builds not on our, self-interested interests, but on this sense of cooperation, mutual self-sacrifice, sacrificing my interests at times for the well-being of the whole group. And, here we're getting into social philosophy today, but it's all related. I see it as all totally related.
Yeah, it is. The whole issue of climate change, which is so front and center right now, depends to a great degree on, I'm 64 years old. What do I care about climate change? It probably won't get me, but I care about it because I do care about my grandchildren and I care about the world. But the problem is, why should I do that? and that, I think that's a big problem in getting people on board, because it's going to require sacrifice, especially for the developed world. Because we may have to decide that we're not going to have some of the conveniences and things that we've come to enjoy if we want to save the planet. So that, again, it gets back to this whole teleological issue.
So, I think this is where, a Christian vision of evolution is helpful, important. So for instance, the way our brains have evolved is that our short-term reward circuits can so easily overpower our prefrontal cortex circuits
right,
of self-control and analysis, of taking the effort to understand if my short-term behaviors that give me a strong sense of reward and enjoyment and pleasure and so forth, if those might actually have negative longer-term effects. And so our short-term reward circuits aren't wired evolutionarily to look at those questions. It's our, our PFC that both stops us.
Prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex. Thank you, Luke. Yes. That stops us to say, hang on, let's do an analysis here. And now that we see the analysis has some negative outcomes, we actually have to control. This part of my brain has to control that part of my brain. And part of why this larger theistic picture is important is because we are called by the creator of it all to say, hang on, I'm calling you really strongly to use your prefrontal cortex and say, hang on, take a look at my actions that may be giving me those short-term rewards, but I actually have to stop and analyze and say, is that good? And what are the self-controls I need to now implement in my life to ameliorate the negatives? And so our scriptures and our Lord calls us to kind of those reflections on how we live, their impacts on others.
Chris, I'd like to talk a little bit about two different parameters, two different qualities of this cognitive machinery that's in our head. The first of which is that it's universal. We see this in all humans. We've seen it in all human societies for thousands of years. So they're all making religions. They're all in search of a god of some kind. So it's a universal mechanism in our heads that's evolving, but it's also a very vague one. It's not precise. It doesn't lead to one particular God, the Judeo-Christian God. And so you asked the question in the paper, I'll just quote it and then you can respond to it or you can answer your own question. Why would God produce a neural system that produces such a plurality of transcendent being concepts, different world religions, different gods? This seems intuitively counterproductive to enabling humanity to identify and relate to the true God. In other words, why is natural theology, in air quotes, natural knowledge of God, so imprecise?
Yes. So that's a question I've been wrestling with for a long time, literally decades. And the whole question of, you know, other religions, as it's sometimes called in you know, Christian discussions, where do they fit into God's plan? Why do these systems of belief that seem to point away from the Trinitarian God of Christian faith, why would God bring about a system that produces such wild and strange and diverse beliefs? And so I was really helped in addressing this question for myself, and this is what turned into the paper, in reading a Christian philosopher, well-known fellow named Stephen Evans. And I've been following his work for literally several decades and been a long admirer of his. And one of the many things he talks about is, as he discusses what we call natural knowledge of God, in other words, what we just come up with on our own without special revelation, he talks about God's strategy or approach to natural revelation as being one in which the purpose of natural theology is not to give us a precise understanding of who God is, of the characteristics of God, as if to pick out, you know, the precise God from all the options. Rather, the purpose of natural theology, of the natural transcendent ideas that our minds as humanity produce, is simply to point us to something beyond the physical. Simply to say, hang on, it's not only the physical exists, there is more beyond the physical. It's simply to urge us to do that search, get us going. And then after that, it's you know, God's job to reveal himself. So when it comes to all these various diverse transcendent proposals that humanity has come up with, gods, nature spirits, panentheism, this wide range that Luke referred to, Evans describes two principles that he believes God has built into the human brain in that search, to help us with that search. And one principle he calls the wide accessibility principle, meaning that access to this idea that there is some transcendent thing, power beyond the physical, is widely built into humanity. So this wide access humanity across the board has to this principle. The other principle is the easy rejectability principle, which is that this belief in some ultimate being is actually quite easily rejected. And so why would God build that kind of principle into us? Well, simply because of the type of relationship God wants with us. God wants a relationship where we freely choose that relationship rather than being coerced. And so sometimes when people say, like, why doesn't God give me an overwhelming display of force to prove he's there? Evans argues that that would be coercive. That would be epistemologically coercive to do that. And so we would not be responding to God out of our freedom. And so Evans proposes that God has built us with these two capacities, both the wide accessibility, all humanity can access these ideas that there's something else out there, but all humanity also is easily able to reject this idea if out of their free will, they choose to reject that belief, because that's the kind of freedom God wants us to operate out of in order to establish a relationship with God. So now, with those two principles in place, Evans says, and I think evolution would support this, but then he says nothing more. He doesn't, evolutionary psychology and neuroscience just isn't his thing. So he wants to affirm somehow this must fit with evolution, but does not have the disciplinary resources for the proposal, how that might fit, because it's not his area of expertise, which is fine. So what proved helpful for me here in reading Evans and then same time reading Torrey and Dunbar and other figures in, you know, evolutionary psychology of religion, cognitive psychology of religion, Justin Barrett and so forth and others, is I saw this really amazing, what I perceived as a consonance between the two. And so it struck me that, hang on, what we're seeing through the evolutionary psychology of religion is this ability to create all kinds of different concepts of transcendent beings, or even to reject any transcendent being, i.e. atheism. And so clearly this belief in transcendence is pretty easily rejected. And yet, as I read the evolutionary literature, it is pretty basic to humanity. It's widely available. It hit me. Hang on. This is widely available, like everywhere, for everyone, unless you just got some cognitive damage there. And so what seems to be happening here, as I put the two together, is that God's evolutionary process has built our brains so there are different pointers that our brains use to point to some ultimate transcendence, causality, telos, purpose, and so forth. It's widely available. But all this diversity of beliefs actually reflects the easy ability for us to reject belief in God. And so that easy, wide accessibility portion of our brains is the portion that just posits lots of different possibilities. And so it was fascinating for me to realize that Evan's two principles are basically fulfilled by what we're seeing in cognitive science and evolutionary science of religion today. And so basically I've weaved the two together to see how they fit. And to my eyes, there's just a wonderful consonance between the two.
So basically you're talking about a mechanism that's evolving in our brains, that was put in our brains and is evolving, that's directing us towards relationship. But are we putting too much emphasis on the human-divine relationship and not as much on the human-to-human relationship or human to the biosphere? So I'm wondering, for example, people will talk about the personal relationship with the divine, and some people can seem to talk about that and feel comfortable. I always get uncomfortable because I just don't understand the term. We've done many episodes that look at what does this mean to say I have a personal relationship with a being that defies all dimensions, way bigger than I can understand. So is it so much a personal relationship with the divine, or is it also something that God revels in? He loves to see humans having relationship with humans. And by that, I mean, just getting along and working together, forgiving and loving and helping and healing and taking care of the planet. And we evolve mechanisms, technology that helps us to take care of this planet and really, build something beautiful on Earth, solve various problems. And we create problems and we solve those. So when we talk about relationship, are we putting too much emphasis on the personal with God, the personal relationship with God, and not seeing how this is something that relates to humans? God revels in seeing the kids playing well. Parents, they love it when the kids are just playing well.
Yeah, there are certainly streams of Christianity, and I've experienced it myself, where the vertical relationship, if you will, is so emphasized that the horizontal, if you will, is underemphasized. I think I hear a couple angles in your question there, Luke. So is the horizontal underemphasized? Do we need to pay more attention to that? And I would certainly say absolutely. I also heard another element in there of what God delights in. And so you indicated, for instance, the example of God delighting in seeing children playing. Absolutely. But I think part of what that triggers for us is the question of, okay, if religious beings, agape-capable beings in relationship with God and each other have only emerged in the universe in the last 100,000 years, 20,000 years, however you want to break out those evolutionary stages, then what was God doing, the previous 13 billion years? Was God bored just waiting for these folk to emerge? It does seem a little anthropocentric to say it all came about, just so God can enjoy watching children in the last, 100,000 years or whatever. Although I do believe God delights in that. But I think we can expand on that and say, I think, God just delights in the unfolding incredibleness of the universe. Mm. And so, yes, God has created the universe with an ultimate purpose. That purpose may simply be his own delight at seeing it all unfold. I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the ultimate purpose. I think the ultimate purpose reflects God's own nature. And I think this is really an important theological point that often gets overlooked in these discussions. is, why has God created the sort of universe that God has created? Because it reflects God's own internal nature. And so God's own internal nature may be to delight. I'm sure it is. So the persons of the Trinity probably do delight in each other. And so God would delight in just, you know, watching the unfolding of the incredibleness of the universe. But I think as Christians, our traditional doctrine of the Trinity is that more fundamental than delight in God's own nature is God's own internal agape love between the persons of the Trinity. And that is the bondingness that enables us to say that though we believe there's a threeness to God, that threeness does not overcome the oneness of God, and God is ultimately, remains ultimately one, even within a Trinitarian view. It's that agape love that makes that possible. And so agape love is going to be the quality that creation is going to reflect. And so when it comes to the point at which in that evolutionary process, God is of the universe, God has been delighting in the unfolding of it all. And then it reaches the point where proto-agape capable beings come along, and maybe God's getting more excited, you know, and agape capable beings do emerge at various, I'm sure, at various places in the universe. I'm sure it's not just on Earth.
Right.
And, you know, God's delight increases all the more and so forth. So these, right. Yeah.
I think that whole time he is, you know, he, there's that personal God thing again. But I would imagine a creative being delighting in this thing unfolding. So, for example, parents love to see their kids grow up to become parents themselves, great, productive members of society. But if you go back to the beginning where you've got the sperm and the egg fusing together, which creates a ball of cells, which then begin to grow in different directions, and then different structures form, but some structures disappear. You know, humans get gills and then they don't, and they get webs between their fingers and they don't, and appendages grow, and the whole thing begins to morph. Eventually, you get a fetus, the baby is born. So a whole process of change. And then this baby is born and goes through the stages of going to school, beginning to learn how to spell, learning how to play on a team in baseball, learning how to play a musical instrument, falling in love, all these stages of this kid growing up, becoming eventually to a productive member of society. And I, as a parent, if I was able to watch from the very beginning, the sperm and the egg coming together, watching all these developmental changes and stages that took 30 years, I would love to watch that, you know? Mm. And I can just imagine this creative being watching this evolving biosphere on Earth producing these agape-capable beings.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, along the evolutionary way, there are dead ends. There are bottlenecks, you know, there are roots that don't end up in these agape capable beings, but still produce immense beauty and delight, I'm sure, in God. They're still valuable in themselves. It's not like, you know, all those gabillions and gazillions of evolutionary pathways that didn't turn into agape capable beings were a waste. No, there's still sources of delight to their creator.
Exactly.
You know, there are, especially in Paul, you know, there's these intriguing hints about creation and about creation groaning, for example, and waiting for the sons of God to be revealed. And there's this whole concept that creation is headed somewhere, and that place where it's headed is eventually somehow to completely glorify God in its love and in its flourishing and the things we've been talking about. That's the ultimate kind of telos of creation. But that comes through this process of really chaos from our perspective. It's always intrigued me that opening of Genesis, you know, that God created the heavens and the earth, there was chaos, right? And then you have this wonderful picture of God as a bird hovering above the chaos and bringing not just order, but really, I think ultimately a loving creation through that chaos. And I think the chaos is that's where the freedom comes in, because you can't have true freedom if you don't have, in a sense, chaos. In other words, God doesn't stack the deck, you know, otherwise it's not real. You know, if I create a robot that's programmed to love me, I don't think that would be particularly fulfilling.
If I could just bring this back to the evolution of religion theme, this reconnects us with part of what Stephen Evans also talks about. So in certain Christian traditions, all other religions are basically evil or at very least wrong. As a follower of Christ, I do believe ultimate revelation, ultimate truth is in him. But part of what Evans is saying in this evolutionary model is he does say, well, then how do we interpret these other religions? If God has built us in a way that intentionally allows our brains to construct other possibilities and other religions, then surely they can't just be purely evil. And so Evans cites approvingly Christian converts who look at their former religion and say, it actually prepared me for the good news that I've accepted. And so I think that puts a more positive spin on our fellow human beings and their searching journeys. And so, I appreciate that part of the picture as well. So in other words, another way to frame it is we've got this evolutionary process that brings us to a point of being able to be in touch with, cognitively in touch with a creator. But then what the next stage is not another evolutionary stage. The next stage is this creator has to respond to us. And that's where the specifics of Christian faith come in. And we say, we believe that God has responded to humanity. Well, first of all, in God's sovereignty, God will respond to whoever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants. So, I mean, that is God's sovereignty. And so I'm not personally going to have a theology where God only acts through the Christian church. And so in response to reaching this evolutionary stage, God responds as God will. But I think God has also, as part of that response, done something very particular in human history and determinative in human history in incarnation and God with us in Jesus of Nazareth. But so the picture there is evolution reaches a point that its purpose has been fulfilled. And now it is God's turn to respond to that and to us.
Okay. Gentlemen, we've gone very long, but Chris, as always, I like to give our guests the last words. Is there anything we didn't cover that you think needs to be covered or said?
You know, I think my final words are just the sense of awe of the creator we serve and the privilege of using these brains that God has given and just the joy of epiphany when two unexpected things come together and give us an aha moment in this journey of discipleship. Just the sense of awe on this journey with this creator.
That fits in well with recent episodes that we've done on that exact topic.
True. Yep. Yes, that is true indeed.
And Chris, any projects in the pipeline?
Yeah, so I don't know where to find the time for this project, but I am, as a next follow-on project, definitely closely related to this, is the relationship between evolution and ethics. And so there are Christians who feel their faith is challenged by current writings in the area of evolutionary ethics. And there are people writing in evolutionary ethics who feel that evolutionary ethics challenges theism, challenges Christian beliefs. And my intuitions are that Christian faith and evolutionary ethics are not in conflict. I do think evolutionary ethics is sufficiently imprecise in its outcomes that it is not sufficient as a moral system for us. But I think there are definite elements in there that God uses and that should be, in this day and age, part of how we understand the formation of Christian moral thought. And so I'm going to be wanting to tease that out more in my next project.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that in a couple of weeks, we're going to be doing a couple episodes on the evolution of morality and ethics in humans.
Terrific.
Okay, Chris. As always, you've been on our show several times, and each time I have to say thank you so much for giving us your time.
Well, it's a joy and privilege for me to be with you. Thank you so much, Luke, and thank you for your perseverance with the podcast over the years, because it's such a valuable program. Thank you.
Okay, thanks again, Chris.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Really enjoy it. Appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjampson@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjampson.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.